Chapter 11. It was not at all pleasant to wait and wait and keep waiting. Temeraire paced and then went aloft to look in case there should be any sign, and then came back down and paced a little more.
"There is no one coming, is there?"
Psyche asked, a little anxiously, worried in another direction entirely.
"No French dragons? Perhaps you should stop going up so much. Someone might see you, and," she added quickly, "if we had to move or had some fuss, it would make it hard for Lawrence to find us again on his way back."
Temeraire tried to settle. He could not help but see the sense in this remark, but he shook his head at her offer of a haunch of cow. The smaller dragons had gone out quietly hunting for all of them, but he did not have much appetite.
"It was not very fair of those dragons," Arkady said, "all coming on at us at once like that. If you ask me, they're all cowards. We should go fly in and get Iskierka out ourselves."
He had recovered his spirits and was eating a sheep, which Lester had gone and fetched for him, with great cheer.
"We are not going to do any such thing," Temeraire said. "There are four times as many of them as of us, with guns and soldiers, and they will only have us down. Anyway, that would not help us get Granby back. They will shoot him."
"And maybe Lawrence too," he added silently, anxiously. It was all the more unpleasant to have Arkady making such reckless suggestions when it was all that Temeraire wished to do himself.
"What are we going to do, then," Arkady returned, "if they do not come back?"
"If they do not come back," Temeraire said, and paused, and lamely finished, "then we will think of something,"
not liking to imagine the prospect. He had thought Lawrence was dead, and it had been just as dreadful in every way as if Lawrence really had been dead. It made one unsure of the distinction between the event imagined and real, and therefore, Temeraire felt, any sort of unnecessary speculation perhaps a little bit of a risk. Lawrence thought such concerns foolishly superstitious, Temeraire knew, but it seemed to him a danger not worth courting.
"What is he saying, the scalawag?"
Gentius asked, scowling at Arkady milkily in great disapproval. He was not very happy with the extra flying which he had had to endure on Amartius's back, or the uncomfortable state of their camp.
"I hope he is properly ashamed of himself?"
"No," Temeraire said, "he is not, at all. And he is making foolish suggestions, too."
"Well, pay no attention to him," Gentius said. "Now,"
and he lowered his voice, "I don't like to make you worry, Temeraire, but have you thought about what we will do if they don't come back right off?"
Temeraire flattened back his ruff, and, unable to repress the desire, went aloft to look again. It was beginning to grow dark out towards the eastern edge of the sky when he went high. There was a vague, watery sort of moon near the west horizon ready to set, and a few plumes of dust here and there, herds of cattle. Not a sign of Lawrence, though, or of Iskierka. And then he looked back the other way and saw a Winchester in harness flying towards them. Elsie landed, panting.
"Oh, we thought we would never find you. What are you doing here? Scotland is not this way. You're going back towards London."
"We are not lost," Temeraire said rather coldly.
He did not much like Elsie. Holland had been a very good ground crew chief. Fellows did his best, but he was perhaps not quite as attentive to the way the harness lay against one's hide, or as prompt in getting it off in the evenings. Not that Temeraire had much harness any more at present, but it was the principle of the thing. And Fellows was a little dull if one were alone in the evening and wanted a little conversation. Besides, Holland had been first. In short, Temeraire had not ceased to regret the loss.
"We have not gone the wrong way," he repeated. "We are only waiting here for Lawrence and Tharkay to rescue Granby. Iskierka has got herself captured."
"Oh, Lord,"
Holland said, sliding down from Elsie's back. He had a satchel over his shoulder.
"When did they go?"
"Hours ago," Temeraire said despondently, "though Lawrence said they should likely need most of the day to reach the city on foot, and then if they could find where Granby was, they would not try and get him out until it was dark and nearly everyone asleep. So they are not late at all. They are in good time,"
and did not mention that he had so lately been aloft looking for them, despite these facts. Holland rubbed a hand over his mouth and said,
"I have a dispatch."
"How large is it?" Temeraire inquired.
and Holin took out a folded snippet of paper from his satchel, handsomely sealed with red wax, and not quite so small that Temre could not see it. But as for reading, no.
"You will have to read it to me out loud," Temre said.
"I am not sure I ought to," Holin said apologetically. "It says it is for Captain Lawrence, you see here."
"I am sure Lawrence would want us to know if it is anything important," Temre said. "Anyway, if it is orders for us, then I suppose that is just a mistake in addressing it by someone who does not quite understand that I am colonel of the regiment myself."
Holin, hesitating, looked around the clearing at the other men. None of them in rank higher than lieutenant, and that dubious.
"Stop looking at them," Poseidon said irritably. "It stands to reason that it is orders for us, and we cannot carry them out without knowing what they are. So either you had better tell us, or go back and see what this Wellesley fellow wants you to do. But if you ask me, he would only be annoyed you had wasted so much time going back and forth."
Holin shrugged helplessly, but this argument carried the day. He broke the seal and read aloud,
"You are requested and required to proceed without the loss of a moment to Coventry, and resume your duties in guarding the withdrawal, instead of—"
He paused in his reading, and then, clearing his throat, finished,
"instead of whatever damned fool start you have gotten into your heads now. If you have forgotten the end of our last conversation, I haven't, and if you won't pay for your damned beasts, you will keep them at their work."
"I do not see why everyone assumes that we are just dashing off madly without thinking where we are going,"
Temre said, exasperated.
"Of course we would be doing that if his Kirke had not got herself captured, but she has, so Lawrence has had to go rescue her, and we cannot go right away because they are not back yet."
"Some of us might go back and join them,"
Poseidon suggested, rather hopefully.
"No, we are staying all together from now on," Temre said. "And Arkady and Iskierka and all of the other ferals will fly out in front where all of us can see them, as they cannot be trusted to behave properly."
And he translated this for Arkady's benefit.
"Bah!"
Arkady said with a dismissive sniff.
"You would have done the same if you were not trying to play at being a human and flapping along as slow as if we had to creep on the ground like them. They have nothing to complain of. We did not leave them in any danger. We would have seen if this Napoleon's army were chasing them as we came towards London. And there has not been any sign of them."
"I would not have done any such thing," Temre returned smartly, "because I would have had better sense than to go wandering off for no good reason, and no particular notion of what to do, just to please myself."
"We had very good reason," Arkady said. "We went to bring food back for everyone that the French were stealing."
"You did no such thing," Temre said, outraged. "Ringe told us you went to get prizes for yourselves, and you did not mean to share with anyone at all."
Arkady had just enough grace to look momentarily uncomfortable, but no more than that.
"Well, it was Iskierka's idea," he said, with a flip of his tail,
and Temre snorted in disdain.
"But anyway," Temre said, turning back to Holin, "that much is true. We have not seen Napoleon's army on any of the roads at all today, and we would have, flying back this way, if they were in pursuit. So he needn't worry."
He trailed off. Wellesley might not need to worry, but Temre realized he himself had every cause. Napoleon's army must be somewhere, and if it were not on the road to London, most likely it was all in London, where Lawrence was, and Granby. Of course, he still could do nothing but fret. Even if they had set off right away, there was no chance of getting to London before it was quite dark, and he did not need Poseidon's anxious, whispered hints to know that it was mad to go trying to fly into a French camp at night, when they had Fleur de Nuit about.
"But in the morning," he said,
and then put down his head without finishing. There would still be guns, and thousands of men, and who knew how many dragons. It would still be quite useless.
"Perhaps he will be back before morning,"
Poseidon said, in a tone so gloomy it left no doubt of her scepticism on that point.
"Well," Temre said to Holin, "you had better go back and tell Wellesley that we will come as soon as I have got Lawrence back, and he should not worry about the men, unless, of course, Napoleon has flown all his soldiers ahead to attack him," he added hopefully.
Perhaps that was what had happened.
"We should have seen them going by, if that is what they were doing," Poseidon pointed out depressingly.
After Holin left, the hours dragged. Temre slept fitfully and uneasily, rousing at every rustle or whisper to peer into the darkness, seeing nothing, and before dawn he was awake for good, and uncomfortable, an unpleasant, sharp ache in the underside of his jaw and all along his neck to his breastbone, where the knotted scar bothered him. He tried to crane his head down to rub his nose against it, but could not quite manage it. His neck felt very strange when he tried, and crackled as he stretched. He could not make his foreleg bend to it either, inward, and at last he sighed and laid himself back down upon the cold ground, thinking wistfully of the warm stone at Lochlagan, or the pavilions in China. There was a faint orange glow of coming sunrise in the distance, to the west. And then he raised his head again, realizing that was quite impossible.
"Oh! Oh!" he cried. "Wake up, everyone!"
and flung himself aloft as Iskierka came blazing towards them, turning now and again to fire flames off into the face of her pursuit, some 7 or 8 dragons trying to get near enough to board her again. There were a handful of men on her back, struggling already.
"Lawrence!"
Temeraire cried, straining his eyes to make him out among the dim figures. She shot by overhead, and the French pursued all of them back-winged as Temeraire rose into their path, scrambling to avoid running into him. Temeraire opened wide his jaws and roared furious thunder on them, a pêcheret point-blank in front, taking the brunt of the attack. The French dragon wavered a moment mid-air, and then a great gush of blood came pouring out of his nostrils, his eyes bloodshot and strange. He sank from the sky, tumbling over himself, and his wings broke beneath him like kites as he smashed into the ground. Majestatis was coming up beside him, and Ballista. The other French dragons, all middleweights, turned tail and fled. Temeraire hovered a moment longer, panting with frustrated energy and confusion. Requiescat was rising too, complaining,
"What is all the noise for? It is too dark to fight."
"We do not have to fight," Temeraire said. "They have all run away."
"Oh, cowards!" Iskierka said, circling back. "They did not mind fighting when they outnumbered me."
She turned her head back anxiously, glaring hotly at the French boarders upon her back.
"Granby, you are well? Are you sure I should not just kill these men?"
"No, they have surrendered, and now they are our prisoners,"
Granby said.
"There is head money for prisoners,"
he added wearily.
"I would rather kill them than have money," Iskierka said. "They hurt you."
"You have hurt him," Temeraire said angrily, "and after I gave him to you too."
And he reached out urgently to take Lawrence off her back.
"Are you quite well?"
he said anxiously.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said briefly, in the way that meant he was not well at all, but he did not like to say anything where anyone else might hear. Temeraire sniffed at him surreptitiously. He did not think Lawrence was bleeding, but it was so dark he could not be sure he was not missing some injury.
"We must away at once," Lawrence added. "They will bring more pursuit, and we have neglected our duty too long. We will have been missed."
"We have been missed, and Wellesley sent a very rude note too,"
Temeraire said to him, turning his head back to talk, when they had all gotten under way.
"Which was not very sensible, but we have worked out that the army has all gone back to London. How did you get Granby away?"
"We had help," Lawrence said.
He was looking at something very small in his hand, which glittered a little golden in the early dawn light.
"Is that a prize?"
Temeraire asked in interest, cocking his head to look at it.
"No," Lawrence said.
The flight to rejoin the British army was long, but at least uneventful. Iskierka gave no more trouble. If she was not much chastened, she was at least very solicitous of Granby, and willing to do nearly anything only to please him, and Temeraire had rearranged the order of flight in any case, so she was directly under their eyes. The ring was like a coal in the small breast pocket inside Lawrence's coat, which his hand kept returning to touch. Heavy beyond its weight, while Wolvie's blood dried cold and stiff on his stolen shirt. Lawrence tried not to think of Edith, how she would learn the news, or what her fate would be, widowed and alone with a small child in the occupied city.
"He was a brave fellow, sir,"
Janus ventured. The old sailor had climbed over to Temeraire, who was lighter burdened than Iskierka for the trip.
"Bad luck we had there."
Lawrence only nodded. He could not go back. His duty lay ahead. They caught up Wellesley's corps that afternoon, and paced them the rest of the long way to camp outside Coventry with a bitter wind blowing south, a taste of the weather they would have in Scotland. The men came marching dully along the road, falling out of step into quicker shuffling as they came at last to the cold comfort waiting for them, ground frozen solid as stone, covered with drifting flurries of snow. At least the wagons rolled easily, wheels clattering. The muddy road had frozen into uneven ridges.
"I don't see why we must be staying up here," Requiescat said, gliding into another slow circle. "There is a nice clearing here below us. We could see just as well from there if anyone attacked, which they won't, as we would have seen them some time the last 100 miles."
"We mayn't land until the infantry are settled," Temeraire said, but then turned his head back and murmured, "Lawrence, why mayn't we?"
"They have less comfort marching than do we aloft," Lawrence said tiredly, "and will sleep in worse. The least we can do in solidarity is protect them until they have established the guard-posts and lit their fires. If you went to your leisure while they yet struggled, it would only arouse envy and discontent."
Temeraire said, "Well, I can hover, but it is not very easy for the others to stay up. We had much better go down there and help them. We could pull up trees for them, for firewood."
Lawrence opened his mouth to say it would throw the men into a panic, but looking down at those slow and weary ranks, he did not think they had the energy to run, even if they had been half dead with fear.
"The smaller dragons, perhaps, might begin."
Temeraire turned and spoke to the ferals, and Gurney led down a handful of them, smallest, to go and pull out the old dead trees from the forest, shaking needles and dirt and squirrels out of the logs as they lifted them up, and carried them by twos and threes to the camp. The men, mechanically breaking up the ground for ditches, did not at first even notice the activity at their backs, and then only flinched when the first logs were put down. They stared up at the dragons with their shovels and pickaxes clutched in their hands. Lester, who had just landed, stared back at them curiously, and then poked his head over to look at the ground and asked them something in his own tongue.
"He wants to know why they are digging," Temeraire said.
And,
"No, no,"
he called, and then went down himself, a descent which did send the men stumbling haplessly away to stop Lester from picking one of them up, evidently with a plan of shaking him for answers, as if this would enable the man to speak the dragon tongue.
"It is for a midden. Stop being so foolish," he informed Lester, and then turning his head back to Lawrence, added, "And I suppose we may help them with this also. I can do what Leanne did at Danzig."
She had used the divine wind there as the French dug their siege trenches to break up the frozen ground and make it easier for the men to dig. But it took several attempts, and the ruin of some 50 trees brought down by excess, for Temeraire to manage the same effect.
"It is not," he panted, having taken a moment to breathe, "quite so easy as it looks. It seems to me it ought to be easier to roar just a little than all out, but it is not. I do not understand why. Not," he added hastily, "that I cannot do it perfectly well. If Lien can do it, so can I."
"Since you are having trouble, I will help too," Iskierka announced, landing beside them, and before anyone could stop her, she had put her head down and blasted flame out onto the ice-packed ground.
A great cloud of hissing steam arose in the centre of her strike, but for the most part the flames licked and billowed away to either side over the hard, icy surface. Happily the ditch-diggers were by now established at a safe distance, watching rather nervously with their officers, and were not singed, but the fire caught in the heap of fallen trees which Temeraire had knocked down.
"Now see what you have done," Temeraire said. "Quickly," he called up. "Fetch dirt and put out the fires."
"Wait," Persaetia said, landing. "If we lay the logs down where you mean to dig the ditches, they will melt the ground, and the men can get warm while they wait." "See, it has all worked out for the best," Iskierka said to Temeraire, brazenly adding, "I meant it so."
He flattened his ruff and said,
"Then you may help put the logs in place, since you have so very cleverly set them on fire before they were lined up properly."
Lawrence dismounted as they worked and went to speak to the sergeant and his men and explain the scheme.
"They won't come this way?"
was all the man wanted to know, wiping a nervous, dirty hand over his blonde moustaches and leaving them streaked and muddy.
"If they do, they will do you no harm," Lawrence said, with no more patience. "And they are saving you an afternoon of hard labour after marching. When the fire in the logs has died down, you will find the ground easier to dig, and you may chop up the remains for tinder and sleep warmer tonight than you had any hope of doing."
Wellesley rode up on his dark horse, wrestling to keep it under control, the animal skittish and shy of flames and dragons both.
"What the devil are you doing, then?"
He did not wait for an answer, but threw an eye over the works and snorted.
"Clever as foxes, I see. Well, don't stand there, man," he said to the sergeant. "Go and clear the rest of that brush. Goran, we'll have the wounded over here, nearest the fires. At least they can't get up and run away from the dragons like ninnies. Half of them haven't legs any more. And as for you and that beast of yours," he added to Lawrence grimly, "finish here and be at the clearings in an hour, no more. I have words for you I don't care to have interrupted."
The horse and the general wheeled away, aides in train, and Lawrence went back to Tamerere, who was pushing the last few logs into place with a broken-off branch to save his talons from singeing. The fire was still very hot. Domaine was already off his back and vanished, as he was wont to do, given even 5 minutes in reach of the ground.
"Roland, go and fetch him out," Lawrence said,
and waited, tapping his thigh, until she came out of the woods some 10 minutes later, half-dragging Domaine along. He had a string of rabbits and squirrels already gathered from the wreckage the dragons had made, and looked surly to have been interrupted.
"Go set up a tent in camp, if you can," Lawrence said, "and then see what you can do in the way of forage for the dragons. Janus, I'm sure you can be of use to Mr. Fellows or Mr. Dorset."
"Aye, sir,"
Janus said.
"You may keep working here until it is done," Temeraire said to Ischiaca, rather smugly, "since it was all your notion,"
and carried Lawrence over to the clearings, where Ballista was already improving their comfort by smashing up shrubs and thornbrake with her barbed tail. Persaetia had managed to establish a remarkable bonfire by setting several of the fallen trees into a tent-pole shape, and using the crushed and pounded wreckage for tinder, although she was now eyeing the towering blaze a little nervously. It had grown a good deal higher than her head.
"A handsome signal," Wellesley said sarcastically when he came. "It is kind of you to spare Bonaparte the trouble of having to find us in the dark."
"You have a dozen fires lit just over the hill in the other part of camp, so I do not think it makes much difference that this one is a little bigger," Persaetia said, in defensive understatement.
"And,"
she added with sudden inspiration, "this is so bright the fleur de nuits cannot come near us. It will hurt their eyes too much to see anything else around."
Wellesley only snorted at this justification and turned to Lawrence.
"And I suppose you have another such clever explanation you would like to feed me?"
"Sir,"
Granby said, breaking in,
"the fault was mine, for letting Ischiaca run away with me." "I imagine there is no shortage of blame to parcel out among you,"
Wellesley said cuttingly.
"It is not Granby's fault at all," Ischiaca said, overhearing. "He did not like our going, and I am sorry now to have disobliged him. But I do not see why we ought to flap along after you like chickens with no one to fight all day. If we are supposed to protect you, we would do much better to go find someone who meant to attack you and kill them before they did. So what I did was perfectly sensible, and it was just bad luck we got captured. And even so, it has all come right in the end, so you haven't any cause to yell."
"Yes, I begin to see your captain might be wholly innocent,"
Wellesley said, eyeing her.
"Granby, is it?"
"Yes, sir,"
Granby said miserably.
"The next time this creature disobeys, you will cut her loose,"
Wellesley said.
"You and your crew will be reassigned. As for her, I do not care if she goes in the breeding grounds or flies across the seas. If she won't follow orders, she is useless, and worse than useless, when she induces others to risk good beasts after bad."
"Oh!"
Ischiaca said, jetting a hissing cloud of steam.
"Oh, I am not useless. I have taken more prizes than anybody. I can beat anyone who tries to fight me."
"Brawling does not impress me," Wellesley said. "We are here to win a war. Not a single battle or a private mill. And any one dragon, like any one man, is expendable. The nation has managed without a celestial or a fire breather this long, and we will manage again without you if we must. If you are spoiling for a fight, you will have one when we are ready to give it to the French. Until then you are going to behave, or you can give up your captain and get you gone. We will find other work for him."
"Granby, you would never—"
she appealed, and poor Granby stood white and wretched, and looked at Wellesley, and then he said, low,
"Dear one, I am an officer of the king."
Lawrence looked away. He did not know he could have passed a similar test. Temeraire was not wilful in the same fashion. His disobedience had been more deliberate and more grave than Ischiaca's. But that was an excuse. If Wellesley, if any superior, ordered him to leave Temeraire, a simple, plain order to go to another duty, and not as a means to abuse. Iskiaka made a low, dreadful, keening noise in her throat, and hissed out a whistling of steam so thick it clouded the ground around her feet. Then she leapt away across the clearing and huddled herself into a heap of coils. Arkady sprang to her side and began speaking to her hurriedly in the dragon tongue.
"I would not care if she did go away with them," Temeraire said, listening. "And if you ask me, it serves her just right. I should be very happy to have you back myself, Granby," he added.
"I beg your pardon,"
Granby said, looking wretched, and ran across the clearing after her.
"You have damned little room to criticize," Wellesley said to Temeraire. "I am not always running off to please myself," Temeraire said. "I have never disobeyed, except when someone tried to take Lawrence from me, or hurt him first, and when the government tried to murder all the dragons in the world.
So you have only been insubordinate or treasonous a dozen times or so, is that all?"
Wellesley said dryly.
"No. Save your breath and the rest of your excuses. Carry on this way again under my command, and I will treat the promises I have made you as cavalierly as you do your duty. Do you understand me? Both of you?" he added. "As I see, I cannot lay the guilt on your handler's shoulders alone. But I will be damned if I try and apportion the guilt."
"Yes, sir," Lawrence said quietly.
"That we have not done anything wrong today. That was all because Iskierka ran off," Temeraire protested. "It is not my fault, or Lawrence's."
"It damned well is, if you are her commanding officer," Wellesley said. "Do not let me hear you blame one of your subordinates again."
"Oh," said Temeraire, quelled, and looked a little ashamed.
"Now," Wellesley said, "if you're finished with this back-talking, since you have spent half the day flying hither and yon, I mean to profit by it at least. Where is Davu bivouacked, and how many soldiers does he have on the road in reach of us?"
"But I told Holland to tell you," Temeraire said. "They have all gone back to London."
"There were 30,000 men behind us yesterday morning," Wellesley said. "I don't care if Bonaparte is chasing them with whips from morning to night, and using dragons for supply. They cannot all have got back to the city in a day. You must at least have seen some sign, pickets or fires."
"Sir," Lawrence said, "there was no sign that any of us saw, either the beast which flew off earlier or when we pursued them. We saw Davout's regiments making camp around London, and Murat was in the city also."
"And I have already told you all," Temeraire said. "They can go 50 miles in a day. We have seen them do it, so—"
"It is one thing to move a brigade or two by Dragonback," Wellesley said impatiently. "Another to move an army. You cannot put much more than 200 men even on the largest beasts."
"That is not how they do it," Pasaitia put in unexpectedly.
The other dragons had all been listening in to the conversation and the lecture with gossipy interest, though hanging back a little. Now she put her head forward to interject.
"They do not just take 100 men and fly with them straight all day. They take 100 men and carry them as far as they can in an hour, and put them down, and those men start marching from there. And then the dragons go back and get the next 100 men, who, you see, have been marching all this time, so they are not all the way off. And the dragons take them forward, for—"
"Wait, they fly back?"
Requiescat said, and with much irritation Pasaitia had to interrupt to claw a picture into the dirt, showing how the companies would each in turn be carried leapfrog over those in front of them, each receiving 2 hours of the dragon's time.
"And so on, until they have carried everyone a little way and given them all a rest," Pasaitia said, "and so the men can walk 30 miles instead of 20, and the dragons fly everyone 20 miles on top of that. So the whole company has moved 50 miles together."
She finished triumphantly, and Requiescat said,
"Well, it seems like a lot of bother to me just for an extra 20 miles. Even I can make that in an hour or two."
And she huffed in indignation. Wellesley had a better appreciation of her explanation, however, and studied the diagram with a fierce, hawk-like intent.
"So this is what Roland has been going on about, then?"
He looked at Lawrence and said sharply,
"Can your beasts manage the same?"
"If the men would go aboard," Lawrence answered him.
"They will go aboard if I have to shoot them,"
Wellesley said. For all his harsh words, however, the next morning he took the Coldstream guards apart and addressed them personally. The 7 yellow reapers and 3 grey coppers were lined up some distance behind him, facing away, so their jaws and teeth could not be seen. They had been rigged out with rope and sackcloth, and his aides were all busily climbing over the dragons, to no purpose but the dramatic, as the rigging had already been thoroughly tried by the dragons themselves tugging on it.
"Men," Wellesley said, "this is a damned sorry state of affairs we're in. That Corsican upstart sleeping in the king's bed, and his bully boy stealing cattle and wrecking the harvest. It is more than any red-blooded Englishman can bear, and we're not going to bear it either for much longer."
"That's right,"
a couple of men called back. "Hear, hear!" and scattered mutterings of agreement.
"Every one of you knows they cannot outfight you, and we have learned they are not outwalking you either. It is all one of Boney's tricks. Those damned lazy Frenchmen are being carried around half the day on dragonback. That is how they have been getting the jump on us,"
Wellesley said, jerking his head back towards the dragons.
"It is time we put a stop to it, and your colonel has solicited the honour of your regiment to go first. It is no treat to go aloft, so I rely on you all to make an example for the rest of the corps to follow. When your sergeants give the word, you are to go aboard the dragons, one to a company, one column to a side, filling the rigging from front to back. The first company, which is aboard in good order, will have the honour of carrying the flag when we give Boney his well-deserved drubbing, and an extra ration of rum in camp tonight. And I hope there is no man here more faint of heart than a Frenchman,"
he added.
"But if there is anyone here who is too craven to go aloft for an hour, he may say so now and be excused."
He nodded to the colonel of the regiment, and himself turned and walked over to the dragons to make a show of speaking with Rowley. No one spoke, and the men filed in perfect order, with something even of a hurry, aboard the beasts. The rest of the army had been roused up to see it happen, and the dragons lifting off with the soldiers all aboard. With only a little prodding from the sergeants, the men aboard all cheered cheerfully at the regiments marching below as the dragons sailed away. The first few days were a confusion of trying to match the supply to the men at the end of the day, and more than one set of rations went astray. They did not manage to go more than 10 miles beyond the usual distance, and the brigades on the road became a wretched muddle, with some regiments on each other's heels, and others separated by miles. The dragons were also not very pleased.
"One of them poked at me with a bayonet," Chalcedony complained indignantly, "and when I turned around and told him to stop, he shrieked. He is lucky I did not toss him off."
But a semblance of order was gradually imposed on the proceedings, and in the end the march, which ought to have taken a long, slow month, was completed in 2 weeks. The advantage of air transport told all the more as they came through the mountains, where the dragons carried the men over the worst stretches. Anywhere snow and ice had made the road impassable. Winter was now upon them in earnest, and they flew deeper into it as they went north, until the Cairngorm range reared up startlingly close one clear morning, and the frozen black waters of Loch Laggan, with the citadel looking down upon it from the heights.
"Oh, at last!"
Temeraire said, with relief, looking down at the courtyard, with its heated stones dark and bare of snow. But Lawrence was looking at something else. There was a dragon already in the courtyard, a papillon noir, gorgeously ornamented with iridescent stripes of blue and green, curled comfortably upon the stones with a flag of parley and a tricolour upon its shoulders. Chapter 12. It was a very great relief to let off his last load of men and supply. Temeraire understood the necessity of moving as quickly as Napoleon, of course, and if he had been disposed to doubt it, Pasaitia's calculations showed plainly how quickly the difference of 30 miles a day, even if it seemed only a few hours flying, would add up, day by day. But it was so very tedious to be going back and forth on these short, hopping flights, an hour in the air, then letting men off, then flying directly back to have another load put on. It was impossible to fly quickly or freely with men clinging aboard to the makeshift rigging, and then there was all the unpleasantness of their dirt. His own crew were well able to handle such matters without getting him spattered, even little Roland, and since the passengers were only an hour or two at most aboard at a time, Temeraire felt it was not too much to ask that they show some restraint, even if they were crammed aboard. But some of them simply could not manage it, and if he only dived a little to catch a better air current, or twisted to keep on an updraft, he was sure to be soiled. All very well to say he had scales, it would take a week of bathing before he felt at all clean again. But the lake was frozen solid, so for the moment he had to content himself with rolling in the thick snow on one of the neighbouring hills until he was wet and cold all over. The encampment had been going up all day as they delivered men by air, and by now the officers were coming up the hill in irregular clusters to eat in the citadel, leaving their horses stabled away at the foot. Lochlagan had an ample herd, and all of them having eaten, the unharnessed dragons began to circle down, negotiating with complex aerial manoeuvres their respective landing places on the hill, whether within the desirable courtyard or near it, or in the clearings farther out.
"Do you suppose,"
Temeraire said to Lawrence in an undertone, as he settled himself gladly down onto the deliciously baking hot stones,
"do you suppose that Sir Laritas will have forgiven me for lying?"
He put his head up over the squirming of dragons, middleweights trying to fit themselves between and around him, and Requiescat and Ballista and Amartius, who smugly had claimed a place with the other heavyweights, thanks to Gentius drowsing yet upon his back. The lightweights and couriers were perched up on the walls and battlements, waiting for the outmatched middleweights to give up before they began their own squabble over who would have a place. Magistratus had ignored all the struggle, and taken himself a place just on the other side of the courtyard wall to the south. Temeraire could hear Poseidia arguing with him indignantly.
"You ought to take a place in the courtyard," she said.
"I am very comfortable here," Magistratus returned placidly.
"You would be more comfortable in the courtyard," Poseidia said, "and you can have a place there if you only make a little push for one. You do not need this one."
"But I like it, and I did not have to push to have it," he said. "The ground is warm." She gave a sulky hiss.
"I dare say you do not even know why.
The hot water for the baths runs under this part of the hillside, too," Magistratus said. There was a brief silence.
"Yes," Poseidia said. "It must, because this is the lower side of the slope, and it must drain away somewhere. But how did you know that?"
"There is steam coming out of that crack in the ground there."
"Oh."
"I am going to sleep now," Magistratus informed her. "I don't mind if you want to share."
"I do not want to share," Poseidia said,
but a low, deep, rumbling breath was the only reply. And after another fit of grumbling, she evidently reconciled herself. Both of them were audible in their snores before the rest of the quarrelling had even resolved itself into a settled order for the courtyard. But there was no sign of Celeritas. The old training master did not sleep in the courtyard himself, of course, but in a private mountainside cave. But he might come out to see them all, Temeraire thought, with some anxiety. He was not easy about having lied to Celeritas when they had come to steal the mushrooms, and he had never had the chance to apologize properly. He was quite sure Celeritas would have understood and approved of the mission. At least he was as sure as he could be, because anyone could take an odd start. But Celeritas might still be angry over being lied to and tricked into having let them in unchallenged.
"He is not here any more,"
a Winchester said. Not anyone Temeraire knew, a small, bright-eyed courier beast in harness. He was perched upon the wall behind them, out of the way of the confusion with all the new dragons coming in.
"I think he's gone to the breeding grounds in Ireland."
"But why ever would Celeritas go to the breeding grounds?" Temeraire protested.
The little Winchester only fluttered out his wings in a shrug.
"It is very boring in the breeding grounds," Temeraire said to Lawrence. "I do not understand why he should have left his post here."
Lawrence did not say anything for a moment, and then he said, oddly, without conviction, "Perhaps he grew tired of the work." He said nothing else. Nothing more reassuring, and Temeraire looked at him sidelong. Lawrence was sitting upon one of the low benches by the wall, looking again at the gold ring which he had brought back from London. He had not said where it had come from, and Temeraire felt a little shy of pressing him. Lawrence seemed so very unhappy, and Temeraire did not understand properly why. They were together, not pent up anywhere, and soon they would have a splendid battle to take back their territory, and then the government would pay them money. So there was nothing to be sorry about, except, perhaps, that they had retreated in the first place. But the rest would make up for that. Temeraire sighed and informed the squabbling reapers,
"You had all better leave some room. Maximus must be here soon, and the rest of the corps. And ought not Lily be here already?"
Lawrence raised his head.
"They all ought," he said. "They were ahead of us."
He went into the citadel to try and find out where the others were from the other officers, and meanwhile Chalcedony and Gladius and Cantarella finally won out over the other reapers and settled themselves down, so the Grey Coppers and the Winchesters and the Ferrells could now squeeze themselves in amongst the rest, and then they were all warm and snug on the heated stones. Monsey and Minnow had settled themselves on Temeraire's back. He felt quite comfortable, ready for a proper drowse, and then the Papillon Noir raised his head and said,
"How pleasant it is here! It is almost as nice as the pavilions the Emperor has built for us in Paris."
He spoke in English, with a curious accent, and many of the other dragons pricked up in interest.
"Those are much larger, of course," the Papillon continued, "so no one has to sleep outside if they do not want to, and there is a charming little stream which runs past them. So if one wants a drink, one only has to stretch out one's neck. But these are just as warm, at least if it is not raining or snowing."
A little drifting snow was indeed coming down in that moment and slicking the stone.
"I expect," Temeraire said rather coolly, "that he is imitating the pavilions from China, which are very splendid."
"Yes, exactly," the Papillon said enthusiastically, "although Madame Lien says he has made them even nicer. And we each have a box at the pavilions where we can put our treasure, and the palace guard keeps watch over it when we are not there."
And I suppose they don't take it,"
Gentius said skeptically, cracking one luridly orange eye.
"No, never," the Papillon said. "I have 3 gold chains and a ruby there, and they are always just as I have left them. The guards will even polish them for me if I ask them."
Everyone was very wide awake now at 3 gold chains and a ruby.
"I have earned them," the Papillon said, seeing he had his audience, "by helping to build some roads and for some fighting, and I have been promoted to captain for it, see?"
And showed off a handsome badge pinned to his harness, a round disc of some shining metal.
"So can anyone who likes to serve the Emperor," he added significantly.
Temeraire laid back his ruff.
"Certainly, if they do not mind helping someone who goes about stealing other people's territory when he already has plenty of his own, and kills heaps of men and dragons to do it," he said coldly. "Anyway, we are getting pay too, and I have been made colonel."
"I congratulate you," the Papillon said. "How much have you been paid so far?"
When Temeraire had made an awkward, sputtering explanation, the Papillon went on,
"Well, I am sure the Emperor would pay you right away, and give you even higher rank then."
There was a low, thoughtful murmur going around. Temeraire put his head sidelong to nudge Roland, who was grudgingly doing lessons with Domaine and Sifo, less of her own volition than at Sifo's insistence. He was beginning to outstrip her as well as his older brother, as Roland had never been very interested in studying.
"You had better go and tell Lawrence that the French dragon is making all sorts of promises, which I am sure are lies, if only we would agree to serve Napoleon, and pray let him come and put a stop to it,"
he finished plaintively. He did not know how to answer the French dragon, who, after all, was offering just what he himself had asked for, except he did not want it from Napoleon, who had invaded England and made so much trouble for everyone, and who let Lien do as she liked.
"Oh, I will go at once," Roland said with relief, and left.
Domaine said,
"I will go too,"
and went after her.
"But who is going to check my work?"
Sifo called after them, unhappily. Lawrence had not gone farther than the great hall of the citadel. Many officers were standing in scattered clumps, talking in low voices that the great vaulted ceiling blended with echoes into hollow, unintelligible murmur, and he hesitated in the entryway a moment. Few faces he knew, and fewer he chose to impose himself upon. Then he saw Riley in a corner of the room. Riley wore a look half-dazed with exhaustion, and he said, wholly tactlessly,
"Hello, Lawrence. I thought you were in prison,"
in a tone more puzzled than condemnatory.
"I have a son," he added.
"Give you joy,"
Lawrence said, and shook his hand, ignoring the rest of the remark. Riley gave it full willingly to be shaken, and gave no sign he noticed the omission.
"Is Catherine well?"
"I haven't the faintest notion," Riley said. "The lot of them took off like a shot for the coast 3 days ago, and she insisted she could not be spared, if you will credit it. Thank God we had already found a wet nurse from the village, or I dare say she would have gone anyway and let the child starve. Do you know, They must be fed every 2 hours. He did not know why the dragons had gone, or where. What little attention he had to spare from the new child was devoted to the Allegiance. He had left her in dry dock in Plymouth, recovering from their voyage to Africa, and with Bonaparte and his army now between him and the port, he fretted about her fate. "I'm sure the Navy will keep him out of Plymouth," he said. "I'm sure of it. But if he should somehow get a hold on the whole South, then—" "Sir," Emily said. And Lawrence looked down. She was panting at his elbow, and Domaine was beside her. "Sir, Temeraire sent me—" "Very well, ass, to tell you, that French dragon in the courtyard is preaching sedition, and trying to bribe everyone to go over to the Emperor with pavilions and jewels and such. He can speak English."
"Where is the envoy?" Lawrence asked Riley. "Do you know who they have sent?"
"Talleyrand," Riley said. The conference was underway upstairs in the little-used library chamber. Wellesley had gone to join the discussion directly on their arrival, and he was, Lawrence thought, the best hope of finding a senior officer who would appreciate the threat. But the room was barred off by guards and aides, among them 10 Frenchmen in uniform like cavalry officers, but altered for flying with long coats made of leather and heavy gloves in their belts. Lawrence did not know how he might get a word inside, until he caught sight of Rowley and called to him. Rowley's personal disdain had not subsided, but he had just seen a month shortened to 2 weeks on Dragonback, and though unsmiling he heard Lawrence out and said shortly,
"Very well, come with me,"
and took him into the room by the side door. Talleyrand had not come alone. He sat along one side of a long table laid on for the occasion, with a marshal sitting beside him, Murat, Bonaparte's brother-in-law. An odd pair, Talleyrand's long aristocratic face under his thinning fair hair almost washed out and pale next to Murat, who had thick curly hair and bright blue eyes in a face ruddy with weather and work, above a powerful frame, in his person every inch the soldier. Murat's clothing was of almost absurd splendour seen close up. A coat of black leather, with gold embroidery and gold buttons over snowy stock and shirt, with gloves of black leather and gold on the table beside him. Talleyrand's of an elegance more quiet and correct. Opposite them sat half a dozen ministers in nothing like the same state, all of them marked with a long and hasty retreat from London, and the discomfort they must have felt at being, effectively, in a military camp. Perceval, the Prime Minister, looked especially drawn and unhappy. His ministry was a shaky and doubtful matter to begin with, a collection of lesser evils and men he had cajoled into their posts. His predecessor Lord Portland's government had collapsed under the weight of the disaster in Africa, and the old man had refused to try and build another. Canning, the last Foreign Secretary, had tried for the post himself, and, failing, had both refused to join the new ministry himself and blocked the Secretary of War, Lord Castlereagh's, joining it, leaving Perceval to make do with Lord Bathurst and Lord Liverpool. Good men, but now more than any other time he needed the most gifted there might be, and though Lord Bathurst had been sympathetic to the cause of abolition, Lawrence could not but acknowledge he was not the man anyone would choose to have sitting across from Talleyrand at the negotiating table. Lord Mulgrave, the first Lord of the Admiralty, had preserved his post. Dalrymple sat with him, an old, fat soldier, and neither of them looking a match for the Marshal. The weight of power and energy and composure was all on one side of the table, all the refinement and sophistication of the Ancien Régime married to the brutal strength of the Empire. Wellesley only, sitting at the other end beside Lord Liverpool, did not look half defeated, and he instead was in a glittering temper, his jaw set coldly. Rowley bent to whisper in his ear. Wellesley looked at Lawrence and then leaned forward and interrupted the conversation going on in French to say, "What the devil is this? You come here under cover of a flag of truce, and meanwhile your dragon is in the courtyard trying to bribe our beasts with trinkets." Murat exclaimed at the accusation and said, "I am sure there has been some misunderstanding. Liberté has much enthusiasm, but he would never mean to so offend." "I am sure General Wellesley does not mean any insult," Lord Eldon jumped in with apologies. "Surely your Highness," Bonaparte was fond of making his family princes, "must be familiar with the frank address of soldiers." Talleyrand watched all the discussion with half-lidded eyes, which flicked to Lawrence a moment. He leaned back to one of his aides with a quick, curled finger for a whispered consultation, and then, when the first exchange had died down, intervened to say, "Perhaps Marshal Murat and I will go and have words with Liberté, to ensure there is no more confusion. We have been speaking long, and a little rest, a little time, would do well for all of us." He pushed himself awkwardly to his feet, bringing the rest out of their chairs, and, leaning a little towards Percival, said, "I hope we will have an opportunity to speak again this evening." Bowing precedence to Murat, he let the Marshal leave the room, and, limping out after him, paused at the door to turn to Lawrence and say, in a clear, carrying voice, "Allow me to express again the thanks of His Imperial Majesty's Government, Monsieur Lawrence, and to assure you that you have a claim on the gratitude of France which the Emperor has not forgotten." The graceful words cut him worse than knives. It was a pain dealt incidentally, Lawrence was bitterly sure. Talleyrand had aimed rather at the ministers at the table to discredit any report which Lawrence might be bringing them.
"Your government, monsieur," Lawrence said, "owes me nothing. I did not act for their sake."
Talleyrand only smiled gently, and half bowed again before he left the room.
"By God, the impudence!"
Wellesley said savagely, scarcely waiting until the door had shut, and in no low voice.
"That arrogant pig, son of an innkeeper and a whore, and married to another, that to be King of Britain!"
"They have made no such suggestion," Lord Eldon began.
He was Lord Chancellor, having risen to the peerage as a notable lawyer, and thence to the Tory government for his steadfast opposition to Catholic emancipation.
"Do you imagine any of that upstart parvenu's circle mean to be content with something as mealy-mouthed as governorship?"
Wellesley said.
"Give him 6 months, and it will be King Murat, as soon as he has taken the army and the navy to pieces."
"No, the terms are unacceptable," Percival said, without great conviction. "But these are a beginning position."
"They are an insult from first to last," Wellesley said, "and ought to be rejected out of hand."
"One of his proposals, at least," another minister interjected. "Gentlemen, I beg we consider on its own merits, apart from any other. May I urge that a swift decision indeed be taken to send their majesties to Halifax, with all haste and all necessary considerations for their security?"
"Defeatist nonsense!" Wellesley snapped. "Bonaparte is not coming anywhere near Scotland before spring, no matter what we do."
"All our scouts report his soldiers are all over the north of England already."
"Foraging," Wellesley said, "in small parties. We have 2 dozen outposts and garrisoned castles between London and Edinburgh, and he cannot march his army past them."
"Surely the least risk ought not be run. Bonaparte went from Berlin to Warsaw on the eve of winter."
"Because half the garrison commanders threw up their arms and surrendered at nothing more than a fanfare at their gates. I have more faith in our officers than that."
"The king is not a young man," Percival said, breaking into the increasing heat of Wellesley's exchange with the minister. "Nor in the best of health."
"No one proposes he should expose himself upon the battlefield," Wellesley said. "But he can still address the troops."
Percival paused and heavily, quietly said, "The king is not in the best of health." No one spoke a moment, then someone said to Wellesley, in a conciliating tone, "If the Prince of Wales stays, or Prince William, and the king goes—" Wellesley shrugged it away, a tight, angry motion.
"If you are determined to send him away, send him. And if you mean to give away his throne too, make a parcel of it with whatever else these snakes are asking for, and let them preach sedition to the troops direct. Why not?"
"Come, General Wellesley, this is surely overreaction."
"If you believe for an instant they did not know perfectly well what the beast was about—"
"I hope we are not going to be distracted by some notion that Talleyrand, if not Bonaparte himself, seriously concocted a plan of subterfuge to be carried out by one dragon among others," Eldon said. "I have heard the idle chatter of the beasts. Let us not read into it conscious and deliberate intent."
"Sir,"
Lawrence said, and bore the looks which he received for having the temerity to interject,
"perhaps you are not aware that dragons learn their tongue in the shell, and do not ordinarily acquire another. It cannot be by coincidence that they brought a beast which could speak English, and easily communicate anything to our own."
"So let them be fed a second time, and it will drive any seditious thoughts out of their heads, if any manage to get in," Eldon said. "What else could Bonaparte possibly offer the creatures, anyway?"
"'Respect, if nothing else,' Lawrence said. "'If you cannot see that the neglect and disdain with which they have been treated "'has left them open to the meanest approach, "'the least offer of courtesy and reward—'
"'That is enough from you, Lawrence,' Lord Mulgrave said icily. "'You have done more good for Bonaparte than Talleyrand and Murat, "'and any 10 yammering dragons could achieve here "'if we gave them every opportunity in the world.'
Lawrence flinched and hoped he did not show it. Mulgrave had approved the fatal plan to send the sick dragon to France in the first place. He had led the inquiry where Lawrence had learned of it by accident. He had chosen the men for the court-martial and personally overseen it. With deep venom.
"'A man may be a wild enthusiast even without being a traitor,' Mulgrave said, "'and you are both. If you have been allowed to live a little longer by counsel other than mine, you are certainly the last man on whom anyone of sense would rely.'
Wellesley said sharply,
"'This is the distraction, and I dare say if Talleyrand could listen in he would congratulate himself on its success. Sir!'
he said to Percival.
"'Throw him out, I beg of you, and Murat with him. Every minute that flag of parley sits before the eyes of the army, you cut a little more of the heart out of my men. We ought to be speaking of the counter-attack, not debating terms of surrender. That is what these are, however you like to dress them up.'
"'General Wellesley, you and General Dalrymple will forgive my bluntness,' Lord Liverpool said, breaking in. "'But unpleasant as these terms are, we may find them preferable to the ones he offers us in March.' I hope my remarks are taken as no reflection upon the army. It is a plain fact that Bonaparte has beaten every army that ever took the field against him, the Russians, the Austrians, the Prussians, the Turks, and we ourselves. It seems to me we might well agree to whatever he wants, so long as the army and the navy are preserved a little while, and the king is safe. Anything that will get him out of London and back to Paris.
Then we can manage Murat.
Are you—
Wellesley cut himself off, and in a flat tone said—
"'While Bonaparte is in England, we can end this with a single victory. Not only the invasion, but the war, this whole 10 years and more of conflict. The last we want is to see him go. The only damned thing to be thankful for is he has put himself in our reach. In a month we will have 50,000 men here, at Edinburgh another 60, and 150 fighting beasts on our own ground. In a month—'
"'Half the Grande Armée is sitting on the coast of France, waiting for their turn to come over for a share,'
Eldon said.
"'In a month— Bonaparte will have 200,000 men or more.
No, he shan't.
The door banged, and Jane Rowland came in, stripping off her bloody gauntlets. More blood streaked her face and hair and stained her coat.
What?
She said to their startled questions, and looked at herself in the glass on the wall.
Oh, I look a fright. No, it isn't any of mine. I suppose it is that poor damned Frenchman's. I broke a sword on the fellow.
She took the glass of brandy anxiously offered her anyway, and drank it off straight.
"'Thank you, sir,'
she said, setting it down. "'That puts life in one's breast.
I beg your pardon, gentlemen, for coming in my dirt. I am fresh from the coast. He tried another landing at Folkestone, but he did not have as much luck as he would have liked, I imagine. We have settled his trick of harpooning. Our smiths have given us some sharp wire, and by twos the courier captains can cut off the ropes in a trice. Here are dispatches,' she added, as Fred, trotting in behind her, laid packets down on the table in front of Mr. Percival. "'From Admiral Collingwood. Taken 6, sunk 4, burnt 2, of ships of the line, and not 1,000 men landed of 60.'
The noise her intelligence produced was extraordinary, both in volume and in the change of tone, out of proportion, perhaps, to a victory that only left them no worse off than they had been before. But even a small taste was sweet to those who had been so long deprived. Eldon was silenced, and Wellesley sprang up to shake her hand before he had quite realized what he did.
"'So he cannot bring over any more. How many men does he have now?'
Percival said urgently.
"'He can still bring them by air by night,' Jane put in. "'We can patrol, and so can the navy, but we won't catch every fleur-de-nuit that slips over the channel. They can carry as many as 200 at a shot.'
"'He may send 10 of them every night for me,' Wellesley said. "'He cannot make up more than our forces before we are ready to meet him. Sir,
gentlemen,' he said, turning to sweep his eye over all the table.
"'No war was won at the conference table, but many have there been lost. Let me not see this a room of cowards, but of Britons. Give me your confidence and 100,000 men, and I do not fear Bonaparte. Will you?'
There was a pause. Several men looked at Dalrymple.
"'Perhaps a joint command,'
one man started.
"'No,'
Wellesley said, cutting him off short.
"'If you have not faith in me—' "'Choose another man!'
The silence fell again, a moment's hesitation, but Wellesley had chosen his moment well. The glow of victory, of success, yet lingered and carried the day. Percival stood and put his hands flat on the table.
"So be it. Lord Bathurst, you will inform our guests the parley is at an end. General Wellesley, you have the command, and may God be with you."
Not a minute later, Wellesley was halfway down the corridor outside, saying,
"A wretched waste of time and spirit, but at least it is over and no irreparable harm done. Roland, I need 100 dragons for transport."
"I can't hand you off 100 beasts when I have 500 miles of coastline to watch," Jane said, matching his stride.
"I have another 30,000 men to get here, and 40 to Edinburgh," Wellesley snapped.
"Tell me where the men are to be found, and where you want them landed, and I will contrive," she said, "with what dragons are on patrol in flying distance."
"Well enough."
He gave her a curt nod.
"Really, get her the list of garrisons," he said over his shoulder. "Tell me, what sort of supply do you imagine Bonaparte needs?"
"For the beasts? 100 bullocks a day," Jane said. "More if he is heavy on fighting weight beasts, and they are working for their supper. He is managing it, though. He has foragers out, of course, and we have fewer dragons south of the mountains to eat up the supply." He nodded.
"Very good. I must get to Edinburgh and get the rest of this army into order."
"Wellesley," Jane said, "before you go, you will pardon me for saying, I can put the men wherever you need them, but I can't make Bonaparte come and meet you there. He is pretty well dug in at London now, and come spring we are going to begin to have some trouble with supply ourselves. Scotland's herds can't support this number of dragons forever. We will be eating into the breeding stock." He shot her a hard look.
"You will oblige me," he said, "by not mentioning that particular difficulty in front of their lordships. Damn, by Miss Castlereagh."
She snorted. "I don't need a lecture on managing politicos who don't know a damned thing about my business."
"No, I imagine not," Wellesley said grudgingly. "Well, bring me the army, and let me worry how to get the Corsican out of London."
Returning to the courtyard, Lawrence found Temeraire in glad convocation with Maximus and Lily, also freshly returned from the coast. The two had unceremoniously displaced several disgruntled yellow reapers and a much-offended ballista to claim places on the warm stones beside him.
"Yes, the egg is hatched," Lily was saying, "but it is not much use to anyone. Only lies there and squalls all day, and I do not like the way it smells. Not," she added loyally, "that any of that is Catherine's fault. I am sure that awful sailor is to blame. I ought never have let him marry her, and now she cannot even make him divorce her."
Harcourt was standing by them, with Berkeley, but Lawrence did not hesitate to approach, even inwardly, too weary and too soiled to dread any more yet another awkward meeting. Catherine did not say anything at all, however, but gave him a handshake which he thought she would have liked to make heartier than her strength could presently manage. She looked fragile as an eggshell, and nearly as white, so her pale red hair stood luridly against her skin, and the blued rings beneath her eyes. She had still the little thickness at the middle she had gained in her pregnancy, but her arms were thin of muscle and of strength. She ought to have been resting. She caught his eye, and said sharply,
"Pray let me not hear lectures. Lily cannot be spared at a time like this. He tried to land another 60,000 men, did you hear?"
"I did, and I congratulate you on the victory,"
Lawrence said. He did not have a right to speak, in any case, as Riley might.
"And on your son," he said.
"Oh, yes," she said despondently. "Thank you."
The French embassy was leaving. A small, sheltering tent in domed shape was put up on the Papillon Noir's back, and Talleyrand was handed into it, clambering cautiously and slowly into his place. But Murat went up like an aviator to the life born, and latched himself on at the neck. The Papillon made a great show of shaking out his dappled, iridescent wings, and showing off a small but flashy medallion on his breast to the other dragons as he was boarded, and he called cheerfully,
"Goodbye! I hope you come and visit me any time you like, in London or in Paris,"
before he leapt aloft. Arkady made a rude noise after him and nosed his own dinner-plate medal, which Jane had awarded him a year ago by way of incentive for patrolling.
"Yes, and good riddance," Temeraire said, looking after the vanishing French dragon with a cold eye. "I am sure he's all a hum, and he hasn't any rubies or gold chains at all."
Lawrence was as glad to see them gone, but they left behind a long shadow, which would not be lifted save by a victory that seemed at the moment distant and unlikely. The terms Bonaparte had offered now would be generous by comparison if he managed to maintain his occupation until the spring. One by one the outposts throughout England would be starved out, or pounded into surrender. Then he would turn the besieging troops upon the port cities, and begin to cut off supply for the navy. Meanwhile his dragons would be eating up British cattle, while their own beasts began to go hungry, and the melting snows would open up all the mountain passes to easy avenue of attack by his infantry. He had only to stay easy, enjoying the comforts of London, and wait.
"We are going out again on patrol tonight, along the North Sea," Maximus said to Temeraire. "Are you with us this next run?"
"Patrolling," Temeraire said with a sigh. "But yes, of course we shall go together. Shall we not, Lawrence? And at least," he added, "it is better than ferrying."
"You may have other duties to your regiment," Lawrence said.
It was no easy matter to organise the whole company of unharnessed dragons into patrols. Temeraire insisted the Yellow Reapers should be allowed to all go together, as they seemed to prefer, even though, by the general rule, they would have been used for balance in mixed groups. And Arcady's ferals, on the other hand, he divided up among many bands, even though they could not speak a word to the other dragons.
"Yes, but they do not need to speak out loud to understand enough for patrols," Temeraire said. "And otherwise they will fly off adventuring. Especially," he added darkly, "if Iskierka is let anywhere near them."
"She is a good deal improved, though,"
Granby said to Lawrence and Tharkey, over dinner snatched one night while they were all encamped near Newcastle. A little way back from the fire, Temeraire and Iskierka were squabbling at volume, and Arcady throwing in his occasional piece.
"She makes as much noise," Granby added hurriedly, "but she has turned perfectly obliging, has thrown all the patrols as neat as a pattern card, and no herring off after prizes at all, or a word of complaint. For as much, I would gladly be captured 5 times over.
Lawrence looked down at the fire. He yet felt too strongly what Granby's capture had cost. He had heard nothing of Edith, though he had stooped so far as to beg Jane to make inquiry of the intelligence officers. Spy reports came in by the dozens each day from London, but the arrest, even the execution, of a solitary British gentlewoman might be too insignificant to mention. Tharkey said to Granby,
"I would not for the world diminish your satisfaction, but perfectly obliging invites caution. A smaller improvement might be more secure. No creature in the habit of freedom is easily persuaded to adopt discipline," he added, giving a gobbet of meat to the kestrel, who observed their roasting rabbit with a cocked and eager eye.
"I am too disciplined," Iskierka said, overhearing. "I will not run off at all, and I am very happy to carry more,"
meaning cattle. They were each carrying half a load of supply along with their crew, Jane's compromise between transport and patrol. Half a load was enough for a party of even middleweight dragons to move a full company with their officers, or to bring in supply for themselves, without waiting the dragons too much to fight. Their own party was presently coming up along the North Sea coast, and gathering what supply they could find. Iskierka was already responsible for the transport of a dozen large black hogs, presently penned up outside the camp and squealing occasionally through their drunken haze. They had been dosed with the easiest drug to supply, strong liquor, and smelled powerfully of spirits.
"If you ask me, it is only an act," Temeraire said disdainfully, "because you are trying to show Granby he ought not leave you. You know perfectly well we haven't any more."
Deer could not be successfully transported, panicking themselves to death before they could even be drugged, and fish did not keep. They were only good for feeding the dragons on the wing. Already cattle had begun to grow scarce along the coast, and the more time they spent inland searching, the more risk of leaving an opening in their patrol, where a substantial number of soldiers could be brought over. Bonaparte had dragons loaded down with men flying along the channel and the coast daily, waiting for just such a chance. Tharkey said,
"We will find more tomorrow,"
a puzzling degree of confidence. But the next evening he took Arcady into the lead, and flew directly to an estate with several handsome dairy farms which yielded 2 dozen bullocks. He watched the stupefied animals loaded onto the dragons with an odd, wry expression, which made Lawrence wish all the more to ask how he had known, and equally made such an inquiry impossible. They were just over the border into Scotland, Lawrence knew Tharkay had been embroiled in a lawsuit here, although none of the details, and if Tharkay did not choose to volunteer them, respect dictated they could not be pursued. The cattle completed their tally, but only just, and they found nothing more the rest of the way on their patrol, and on the flight to deliver their supplies to Lochlagan. The farmers were grown adept at hiding their diminishing herds.
"Damn the lot of them, and bony too!"
Jane snapped, when Lawrence gave her the news, and rubbed the back of her hand across her forehead.
"Tell him we have 1 week less of supply than I said,"
she told the aide hovering at her desk, the young man, an army officer, at once nervous and impatient, shifting his weight side to side.
"And no, he mayn't have 20, he may have 10, and not all of those heavyweights either. Wellesley wants you,"
she added to Lawrence, and tossed him a wax-sealed packet from among those upon her desk, "and as many as I can spare in Edinburgh." Lawrence broke the seal and unfolded the orders. A single sheet, a few lines only, hastily and informally written, with no signature. "Bring that fire-breathing monster, and however many more Roland will give you. The best fighters you have, and the more vicious, the better." He read it over slowly, and then folded it back up again. Vicious was a cold, indigestible presentiment in his belly. Jane, he thought, had not seen the contents. She would object as strongly as he would. And he looked up. She had scarcely interrupted her work.
"Fret, have Rightly take himself and 5 middleweights to Inverness, and send a note to that damned colonel that if he don't get his men on board tomorrow night, when the beasts land, I will have him up for a court-martial the next morning. We haven't time to waste on this nonsense,"
she said, handing off 3 orders at once.
"Lawrence, you may choose your beasts, anyone you like. Formations make no never mind."
He could not burden her.
"We may have 10,
Lawrence said.
"Wellesley wants Iskierka," he added.
"Yes," Jane said, distracted. "You may as well take her. Lord knows it is a waste to have her patrolling if there is skirmishing to be had. Oh, and here," she added,
giving him a letter dug out of many others on her overburdened desk.
"You may read that here, although I cannot let you take it."
A hand had written, broadly and with many misspellings and stray capitals, "The lady in question is watched, but not yet molested. I have contrived to whisper in a few ears that her husband was a known enthusiast, and she married late in desperation. May she one day forgive this slur against her, and upon the name of a hero of his country. I hope the danger of arrest is past. This is all I can convey reliably, as she refuses to receive me as a caller, but gossip says she is much grieved and the child continues sick. Tomorrow I am invited to dinner with Marshal Davout, but do not expect much, as he is close-mouthed, unlike Monsieur Murat." The letter had no signature. He read the section over twice, and gave it back again.
"Thank you,"
he said only, and bowing, left. He did not trust himself to say anything more. Temeraire was very pleased to be so singled out for a particular assignment, and even more to be let off the job of patrolling and ferrying men about, however important it might be. The only difficulty was in deciding who should be chosen to come along.
"Wellesley wants the best fighters you have, and the most enthusiastic,"
Lawrence said, which was only fair anyway, as those had the most right to be doing something more exciting than carrying the infantry back and forth. But there were more than 10 deserving, and anyway it was only 8, because of course he should go himself, and another would be Iskierka, even though she did not merit the privilege at all. It was this showy fire-breathing, which was not anything particularly extraordinary. Anyone could set things on fire if only you had a little bit to start with. Temeraire sighed, but anyway she was not of much use. She had already been let off carrying people because it was difficult for many people to sit upon her with all her spikes jetting off steam as they did. So he had to put up with her. And then, of course, Maximus and Lily had to be asked, although to Temeraire's startled dismay, Lawrence tried to speak against the choice.
"But it would be very unhandsome of me not to invite them for some real fighting when I may,"
Temeraire protested, looking over his shoulder lest Maximus and Lily should overhear and be offended. Fortunately, Maximus was solidly asleep and snoring under a blanket of 9 Winchesters and little Ferrells, and Lily was presently encamped outside the far wall of the citadel, just below Captain Harcourt's window, jealously.
Catherine was gone inside to see to the baby.
"Harcourt is not well, I find,"
Lawrence said.
"Yes," Temeraire said. "Lily thinks so too, and that is as much a reason to ask her as any. She is quite sure Catherine must do better to go south and have some real fighting than all this flying back and forth in the wet. She takes cold so easily now, and ought not be so long aloft."
"Berkeley don't take cold easily because he is so fat,"
Maximus said sleepily, cracking open an eye.
"But I would also like to go and fight."
So that was settled. But for the rest, Temeraire scratched his head a little.
"Gentius may as well come with us, without counting against our tally," he said at last, "because it is not as though he can carry anyone or patrol. He is only staying here in Lochlagan and sleeping. And we shall have Armatius to carry him. That would do very well for heavy weights. I do not think I ought to take Magistatis or Ballista, for they are so very handy at managing the others, and I am not quite sure that everyone would mind so well carrying the soldiers back and forth if they were to leave also. And Requiescat, because no one who is not a heavyweight will argue with him, even if he must be told what orders to give." He was a little puzzled how to leave them behind without giving offence, however, until he hit on the notion of giving them rank instead.
"You do not suppose Wellesley can mind?" he asked Lawrence.
"It is a capital scheme," Admiral Roland said in amusement, when Lawrence had inquired of her. "Your militia had better be shifted under command of the corps in any case, so we will make you a commodore instead of a colonel, and your officers shall be captains, although it will be damned difficult to manage epaulettes for them."
"Oh, epaulettes,"
Temeraire said eagerly. A party of seamstresses had been recruited from the local villages around Lochlagan to help sew carrying harnesses for the transport of the soldiers, and they were now induced to make up rosettes out of some of the leftover silk and leather. The results were not very like real epaulettes, nearer, instead, to enormous mop heads of the brightest colours, with a little cloth of gold at the knotted centre for some flash, and a great many ties to attach them to a bit of harness. But no one minded that in the least.
"I call that handsome," Requiescat said, admiring the bright green knot upon his shoulder from every direction, craning his head nearly upside down. And even Magistatis did not quite manage to affect his usual degree of amused disdain, and kept glancing back sidelong at his own. It was in red, to go against his cream and black, and looked almost as fine, Temeraire thought, as his own pale blue matched set. He, of course, had needed two.
"Yes, and if anyone should be particularly clever at helping you to manage, you may make them lieutenants, and they may have a smaller one,"
Temeraire said.
"So that is all settled," he added to Lawrence, "and for the rest, let us take some yellow reapers. Messoria and Immortalis, of course, because they are our wingmates, and also the two best of our unharnessed, and that will do very well, because I also want Persaitia. She is very clever, and," he confided, "if I leave her here she will offend someone, I am afraid. Anyway, we may need to manage some artillery."